Let's begin by turning over to the book of Matthew as we begin the sermon message here this afternoon. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24, and beginning in verse 36. Matthew chapter 24, and verse 36, we read, "But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only." So here we have Jesus Christ giving us a specific warning that if someone tells you when they know Jesus Christ is going to return, don't believe it, right? This is Jesus Christ's own words saying only the Father in heaven knows that timing. Verse 37, "But as the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man," right? So we have this hint that Jesus Christ gives us, right? This hint back toward these days of Noah. And he says, like in Noah's day, so also will be the second coming of man. "For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man be." So here we see a flashback to a time of greed and self-centeredness, certainly a time of free thinking, a lack of morals, a time of blurring of the lines even of mankind's history. And if you think back to those days of Noah and the account that's recorded for us back in Genesis, we see this time of great sorrow in God's eyes. Remember, he came down and he was sorry for mankind. He was sorry for what they were doing and this sinful, lawless way of life that they were living. Verse 42, "Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed the house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." And so we have this interesting flash forward to Christ's second coming, where he says, only the Father knows, but remember the days of Noah, right? Remember that it's to be like the days of Noah. Those individuals were going about their life. They were immersed in the society around them. They were blurring these lines. They were involved in a lawless type environment and life that was absent of God, and this flood came upon them rather quickly. 2 weeks ago, in the last sermon that I gave in the part one on this series, we talked about becoming desensitized. We talked about how it's easy to let the environment around us begin to seep in at various degrees in our life. We read several verses to describe what evil is, and we can certainly look objectively about the world around us and see the evil that the world has, but sometimes we can very much discount maybe how some of that world and some of that society is even creeping into our own life. We talked in that first sermon about how Jesus Christ didn't pray to the Father to take us out of the world, but rather to keep us from the evil one. And so the main question in the last sermon was, how do we live and function in this world? How do we live and function in a world that Jesus Christ asked the Father not to take us out of, but to keep us from the evil one? How do we live in the world but yet not be a part of the world? How do we guard against becoming desensitized about all the evil and all the lawlessness that goes on around us? How do we prevent even a silent acceptance of some of the things of the world's standards? The homework, if you'll remember, was given toward the end of that sermon. It was simply to identify some of the evils that you see in the world around you. Some of those maybe were not things that were seeping into your own life, but sort of this slow trend toward lawlessness that you see the world finding themselves on. Certainly the homework pointed toward us, and for us to take some time to go through a self-examination of our own lives and see how we might be sliding a little bit toward this ungodliness of the world that maybe we're not fully aware of. Areas of our life maybe that we're becoming even desensitized to the evils of the world. Entertainment was perhaps the easy one for all of us. Rand and I started, I don't know, two or three different movies this last week, and we've sort of adopted this 10-minute rule, and one of the movies didn't make but a few minutes into it before we thought, nope, this isn't for us, and we left it, we changed it. Entertainment perhaps is one of the easy ones, but what about maybe less obvious areas where we're becoming desensitized? Have you considered maybe marriage role reversals, right? This is huge in our society, where we have this role reversal of these marriage components that God has called each of us as men and women into. And society is slowly changing those roles to be focused on the other person. What about child-centered families? Another big one in our society. Are we letting some of that creep into our families, where the child is at the center instead of the parents being at the center and that child being a welcomed addition? How about just selfishness of me first, you second, or you third, or maybe you never, but let's talk about me. Right? Let's focus on my needs and what I want. The finances of today can easily creep into our lives as well. The buy now, pay later philosophy. We don't really have the money for this, but we've got this piece of plastic. Let's go ahead and buy it, and we'll figure out how to pay for it later. Right? Sometimes these things can creep in. This is not God's way of life. These are not God's laws and ethics and his things that frame who he is. But sometimes we allow these things from society to creep in. How about even being thankful and showing gratitude for effort and sacrifice given? These are things that society shrugs at. And it's all too easy for us to, again, slowly align ourselves with some of society's values. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 9 says essentially that Satan has successfully deceived the whole world. Satan has hoodwinked, you might say, the whole world. He has deceived the whole world. And we can very easily sit here today as God's people and say, that's not going to happen to me, right? Not me. I won't let them. And if I look at my life, I can see, Satan hasn't deceived me. I keep the feasts, I keep the holy days, I go to church on the Sabbath, I do these things, I don't eat pork. It's whatever the case might be, we can lay out our scenario and say, no, Satan hasn't deceived me. I'd like to read a short quote from C.S. Lewis. Now, let me put the disclaimer out front that I'm not a fan of C.S. Lewis. Okay, I don't care for... I'll just put that out there. I'm not a fan of C.S. Lewis, but this one short letter that he wrote is... interesting from the perspective of what we're talking about here today. This excerpt comes from the Screwtape Letters, and it's written from the perspective of a senior assistant to Satan to sort of a novice demon. And they're discussing the demise of a young man. And so here's one of the excerpts from the letters in this book. C.S. Lewis writes, quote, "You will say that there are very small sins, and doubtless, like all young tempters, you're anxious to be able to report spectacular wickedness. But do remember, the only thing that matters is the extent to which you separate the man from the enemy, from God. It does not matter how small the sins are, provided their cumulative effect is to edge the man away from the light and into the nothing. Murder is no better than cards, if cards can do the trick. Indeed, the safest road to hell is the gradual one, the gentle slope, the one with the soft underfoot, without sudden turnings, without milestones, without signposts, end quote. This is how Satan works, isn't it? It's not the next billionaire that he's looking to make. It's not the next nightclub owner with the raunchy music and the scantily clad waitresses. He's not looking for the next murderer. For the vast majority of mankind, he's looking for the gradual slope to destruction. And if he can get you and I to begin to take little minute steps toward that way, then we also will be on that slope toward destruction. Remember last time we went to 1 Peter chapter 3, it's the verse that talks about Satan being like this lion that wants to devour us. The interesting thing about that verse is Satan wants to devour us in a way that we don't know that we're being devoured. Right? He seeks to deceive us, mankind in general, in such ways that we don't realize we're being deceived. He wants to do it in such a way that it doesn't raise any flags in our mind. He wants us to be able to sit back and say, nope, God has called me, I am not being deceived. Right? He wants us to think that we're not. Because if he does raise a concern, if he does push a little too hard and some little flag pops up in our mind, what do? We acknowledge it before God, we fast, we pray, we ask God to give us strength, to forgive us of that sin, and all of a sudden, we rewrite ourselves with God's way of life, don't we? But if he can do it gradually and in small, minute movements, then maybe it won't raise the flags in our mind. And maybe then we can continue down that gradual slope leading toward destruction. Today, I want to look at Satan's tactics. He has three tactics that he uses over and over and over and over again. And it's these three tactics that I would submit to you he uses to gradually desensitize us. Gradually, he uses it to gradually deceive us. Choices shape who we are and what we become. You might recall back with the children of Israel, the Israelites, they had many choices that were presented to them. And they oftentimes failed miserably, didn't they? They would fall for this idol. They would fall for that pagan god. They would fall for this thing over here. They would bring that piece of culture or religion of that neighboring nation into their tent. Even out of their environment of Egypt, they sinned. And when we look down toward even the grandkids of the people who crossed the Red Sea and later even the Jordan, they continued to turn to idol worship, didn't they? They continued to walk that way, to turn toward idols, to embrace sexual immorality, to look to the foreign gods. Generations later, we see them falling as their forefathers did in many of these same ways. Let's go back just a few chapters to chapter 7 here in Matthew. Matthew chapter 7, one of the reoccurring comments that I received 2 weeks ago here in Tulsa and in Oklahoma City about the last sermon was, Mr. Dowd, it was a good sermon, but that's going to be really hard to do. That's going to be really hard to do. And indeed, I find myself here in the same place. Yes, it is hard to do, isn't it? It's hard to live God's way of life. It's hard to look at ourselves objectively and take that hard, honest look to say, okay, am I slowly becoming desensitized to the world around me, allowing these evil things of Satan to sort of slip into my life? Notice Matthew chapter 7 here in verse 13 and 14. This is Jesus Christ again writing or speaking. He says, enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And there are many who go in by it. We know this first verse from how the Bible describes as Satan's way, right? This is the way of life that is opposite God's way of life. It's the way of get. It's the way of selfishness. And it's a broad way. It's a broad way to lead to destruction. Broad roads we're familiar with. Right? If you've traveled recently to Oklahoma City over the last several years, the first 20 or 25 miles coming out of Tulsa, that is a beautiful road, isn't it? I'm not sure there's a single turn in that road. There's some slight hills. Speed limit is 80 miles an hour. Cars sometimes will pass us doing much more than that. But it's a wide road, right? The lanes are wide. The shoulders are massive. It's the wide road. And it's the easy route to Oklahoma City. Get on it, set the cruise, right? And you don't really have to maybe even pay much attention. Lots of room for the cars to pass. The trucks know their place. The fast cars know their place. And the whole thing moves. It's a broad road. It's an easy way. Now, I'm not saying Oklahoma City is destruction. That's the road that leads to destruction. That's not what I'm saying. But we have these broad roads. We have these wide roads. And those wide roads are easy for us to travel on. Verse 14, but narrow is the gate and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it. We have this little road next to our house. It's called Lynn Lane, and it runs from South Broken Arrow up through the northern part of Broken Arrow. And at some point, it becomes very commercialized and a lot of retail shops, and there's some schools up there and lots of stop signs and traffic lights and such and lots of traffic. But down in the southern part of Lynn Lane, where that road actually begins, it's a great road. It's country. There's large pieces of property. It's windy, but it's also very narrow. Right? And even in our large truck, if there's another large truck coming, you really have to focus and concentrate. There's no shoulder. There's no berm. There's just a ditch. Right? And so there's hardly any wiggle room on that road, especially if it's a larger vehicle coming the other way. Narrow is the gate and difficult is the way that leads to life. This is the road spiritually that you and I should be on. Not the 6-lane highway with the speed limit of 80 that doesn't have any turns. It's just straight and easy and cruise control oriented. God's way of life is that narrow road. That road that takes concentration. That road that takes effort. It takes effort to drive the south part of Lynn Lane. Doesn't take much effort to drive I-44 out to Oklahoma City. It's the effort. It's the cautiousness. It's the deliberateness that is required for that narrow gate, for that difficult road that leads to life. And there's blessings that come from it. Tremendous blessings that come from it. Has it been hard to remove favorite songs from your Spotify playlists? Maybe, maybe not for you. Is it hard not to watch the latest Hollywood-written, immoral-based movies? Is it hard to focus on godly principles of marriage rather than sort of the role reversals that society teaches now? Again, we have these two paths. One is easy. One, we can just sort of let the entertainment run wild. One, we can sort of let our marriages go however the marriages go. We can let the kids do whatever the kids will do. We can let our own needs and desires sort of run unchecked. And this is what we see here in verse 13. That is an option for our life. But it's not the way that leads to life. And it's certainly not the way that only a few find. But rather, it's the other road. It's the road that takes concentration and effort and deliberateness. Choices shape who we are and what we become. And so if we want to reflect godly principles and standards, then we have to be selective. We have to be selective in the choices in our marriages and the choices when it comes to things we need versus what the other person needs. We have to be selective in what we see, what we listen to, how we approach each other. We have to carefully consider where we put our time and our effort, when we make sacrifices, when we give, when we share. We should be constantly evaluating our lives and behavior so that our life reflects biblical standards and the high calling that God has given to us. Let's go back to the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3 describes for us the first human sin. Genesis chapter 3, and let's read together the first six verses. Genesis chapter 3 and verse 1. Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, "Has God indeed said, 'You shall not eat of every tree of the garden?'" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, 'You shall not eat of it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die.'" Secular commentaries are all over the board with these first verses. They sort of try to shift the blame onto the serpent. They try to shift the blame away from the humans. Eve very clearly understood God's law, though, didn't she? She very clearly understood. God says we can eat of everything except that tree. She understood. She knew. And yet her choice was against God. Verse 4, then the serpent said to the woman, "You won't surely die. For God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." So when the woman saw the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. So here we have this sin that's recorded for us, a blatant sin. It's not a sin out of innocence or ignorance. Right? Eve wasn't somehow confused, or God wasn't clear with her on the expectations of what she could eat and not eat in that Garden of Eden. She knew, and she purposely made a choice the other way. But notice Satan's tactics here in verse 6. Right? It was good for food, pleasant to the eyes, and number 3, it was desirable for knowledge. These are Satan's three main tactics. He uses it here at the early, very early pages of Genesis, and we see it throughout the rest of the Bible. And coming forward into our own lives, hopefully we can see these three tactics being lobbed at us, being tempted before us as well. Eve internalized the deception. She thought about it. God's absolute truth is just a page over, Genesis chapter 2 and verse 17. There is absolute truth. Right? God gives absolute truth in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 17. And Eve in chapter 3 says, I don't want that truth. I want to decide for myself. And I'm going to use these three things. And oh, doesn't this look grand? Let's go to 1 John chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 15. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 15, the apostle writes, he says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." That alone is a statement that should sort of make us stop and sit up and give some consideration to. Notice verse 16. "For all that is in the world," okay, he's about to say everything that's in the world, and if we have these three things, then the love of the Father is not in us. Okay, so we have verse 15, don't love the world, don't love the things in the world, and then he goes on in verse 16, the very next verse, and he tells us what those things are. Number 1, the lust of the flesh. Number 2, the lust of the eyes. Number 3, the pride of life. And he concludes verse 16 by saying, these are not of the Father, but of the world. And the world is passing away, verse 17, a lust of it, but he who does the will of God abides forever. I would submit to you that these are probably the things that you've been identifying over the last 2 weeks since the last sermon. Maybe some of the things that you found in your life of where you're becoming slowly desensitized, I would submit, fall into one of these three buckets. They would fall into one of these three concepts. So let's notice these here. The first one is lust of the flesh. Lust of the flesh. These are temptations that reside in the flesh. They reside in the flesh. With lust of the flesh, think physical gratification. Physical gratification. It can be physical possessions, or it can be something else, but it's the things that you look at in your life that give you great pleasure. It's the things in your life that are pleasing to you, that are pleasurable to you. Again, it can be possessions, clothing, jewelry, house, car, that sort of thing. But it's anything that's pleasing. Again, physical gratification. It's physical things that bring some level of gratification to you. But this one is custom made, right? Because what's physically gratifying to you may not be to me, may not be to this person, to that person, right? So Satan uses this and custom makes it for each of us. The second one here, the second item in verse 16 is lust of the eyes. This is us being satisfied with contemplating. We're satisfied with contemplating. For this one, we can think mental gratification. Think mental gratification. There's a heavy use of imagination here with this tactic of Satan. It's the things you dream about. It's the things that maybe even are over the top, right? Some career advancement, some big pay raise, winning the lottery. Sexual imaginations are here as well. But this is also where coveting lies. When we covet, this is the tactic that Satan is using. This is where coveting lives. There's little physical action when it comes to coveting, but the mental side is huge, isn't it? We see somebody that has something, and we play these tapes over and over in our head about why does that person have it and not me? I should have it. I'm better. I'm this. I'm that. I need that, not them. Right? Again, it's these mental thoughts. It's the human logic and reasoning. There's a tug at the emotions. It feels good. Again, custom made for each of us. Custom made by Satan himself. The third one here in verse 16, 1 John chapter 2 and verse 16, is the pride of life. The pride of life is simply a vain assurance in our own resources. Okay, it's a vain assurance in one's own resources, in the stability of what they perceive those resources to have. It can be power, it can be control, it can be some sort of prestige, it can be a personal viewpoint that people even look to you as something great. Right? Oh, I'm this kind of person, and people come to me because of what I can impart to them, or because of my abilities, wisdom, resources, capabilities, thoughts, whatever it is. People come to me, and I provide this thing to them. Right? This is all this vain assurance. This third one is simply the greatness of me. Right? It's the greatness of me. It results in a lack of trust with God because you seek to know more than God. This one, too, though, is also custom made for us, because what triggers you may have no consequence to me, and the things that would trigger me may not be a temptation for you. So this one, too, like the others, are custom made. These all come in a variety of forms based on the person. But at the root, they're all the same. They all come back here to what the Apostle John describes, and we see it all the way back to the Garden of Eden with how Satan tempted Eve. But these are all gradual. Right? These are all gradual things. Remember that Satan is cunning. He doesn't want to raise any red flags, because when he raises red flags, we go to our knees, we fast, we pray, we study, we ask God to forgive us. We ask God to bring us back to that narrow gate and that difficult road. So he doesn't want to raise any red flags. If he can get half a degree of movement out of you this week, he's good with it. If in a couple more weeks he can get you to shift another quarter of a degree, he's good with that. And pretty soon you'll be headed right for his dinner plate. I want you to think back to the Garden of Eden, though. Think back to Eve, right? She said that it was good for food. It was good for food. This is the lust of the flesh. There was a physical gratification that was there. She saw it as something she could take and eat, some physical thing. She also saw that it was pleasant to the eyes. Right? This equates with the lust of the eyes. There's an emotional connection. There's an emotional bond that she had with that temptation of Satan. It felt good. It was pleasant to the eyes. The third thing that she said was it was desirable for knowledge. Desirable for knowledge. This is the pride of life. Knowing more than God. Knowing more than God. Let's go to Matthew chapter 4. We can see these same tactics being used against our Messiah. He's baptized here in the last part of chapter 3. We see him being baptized as an adult, not as a child. So at the end of chapter 3, we see his baptism recorded. We see the full immersion here as well, not a sprinkling, not a dashing. Chapter 4, then, we see immediately after his baptism, he's led off into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil, verse 1. And I want you to see that through these three temptations that are recorded for us, Satan uses the same tactics. Notice verse 3. Now the tempter came and said to him, he said, if you are the Son of God, I'll just throw this out as a sort of side point. Satan knew very well who Jesus was, didn't he? But yet he's playing these mind games, right? If you're the Son of God, right? If. There's no if. He knew exactly who Jesus was. But rather, this is the statement that he makes. If you're the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. You're hungry, Jesus. You've been out here for a long time fasting. All you have to do is snap your fingers and these rocks can become this full board meal, right? You can eat till you're full. Here we have the lust of the flesh. Remember, it's a physical gratification. The stomach is growling. The throat is dry. You're hungry. You're weak, right? Satisfy yourself physically. All you have to do is snap and these stones can become bread. Verse 5, then the devil took him up into the holy city, set him on the pinnacle of the temple, and said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it's written, he shall give his angels charge over you, and in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. Right, here's the temptation about being above God's authority. Right, you, Jesus, can control what God does, because Satan here is saying, we both know that God won't allow anything to harm you, right? So if you jump off, God has to protect you because you can't die. Not yet, right? So Satan here is playing on the pride of life. Right? He's using this tactic of the pride of life. You're above God. You're a God, right? You can control what the Father does. You're human, you jump off. If God doesn't protect you, you go splat, right? And then where will the plan be? And so Satan here is playing on this pride of life. You can be above God. You can control what God himself does. He'll send his angels. Verse 8. Again, the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory, and he said to him, all these things I will give to you if you will fall down and worship me. Think of how great you could be, right? You don't have to go through this crucifixion thing. You don't have to go through these terrible events that are likely to come. Instead, all you have to do is acknowledge me as your ruler, and I will give you everything you can see. Just imagine, right? Think about it. Think of the glory. Think of how great you could be. Here we have the lust of the eyes. It's the mental stimulation. Think about it. Reason it. Consider it. Everything you can see and more, right? How would you like to rule over all of this? How would you like to do this? How would you like to be the guy in these areas? Over thousands of years, Satan's tactics have never changed. They've never changed. It's the same basic process. He'll try one. If it doesn't take, he'll try the next. He'll try the third. And of them, one usually sticks. Again, he's not looking for great swelling sin out of us. He's just looking for that fractional degree movement. Just move a little bit away from God. Just move a little bit toward the lust of the flesh or the pride of life or the lust of the eyes. Just move a little bit this direction. Now let's go forward a few chapters to chapter 13. Matthew chapter 13. And here we have the parable of the sower in verse 3. Matthew chapter 13 and verse 3. And he spoke many things to them in parables, saying, "Behold, a sower went out to sow. And as he sowed, some seed fell by the wayside, and the birds came and devoured them. Some fell on stony places where they did not have much earth. They immediately sprang up because they had no depth of earth." Verse 6, "But when the sun was up, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. And some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up and choked them. But others fell on good ground, yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. He who has ears to hear, let him hear." This is Satan's con game. This is what Jesus Christ is describing here. Have you ever wondered why not all seed takes? Here you have the incredible God of the universe. You would think that when he throws seed out, that all of it would take, right? If God offers a calling to us, why is the response to that calling not guaranteed? Why is the church not millions of people? Why is morality not at the highest? Why isn't marriage sacred? Why isn't the family unit strong and secure? Instead, we see a society around us that's filled with lawlessness. Relationships have challenges. There's greed and selfishness that's present. There's the famous line in the old Disney movie about the golden rule. Do you remember the golden rule? He who has the gold makes the rule. Right? This is the world we live in, right? If you have the gold, you make the rule. And it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks because it brings the focus back to me. This is our world, though. This is its entertainment, its politicians, its society. Satan wants it all to fail. He wants society to become desensitized and to simply go with the flow. You can do it on your own and probably better, Satan says. You're smart. Make your own decisions. Lean on your own understanding. You're a smart person. Here in Matthew 13, this is one of the parables where Jesus Christ gives sort of the decode to it. He fully explains it. Not all of his parables he does, but this is one that he fully decodes for us. And he explains it in verse 18, Matthew chapter 13 and verse 18. "Therefore, hear the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom of God, hears of the word of the kingdom and does not immediately understand it, then the wicked one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart." Notice that it's not just the person on his own accord that walks away. Right? Satan's involved. Right? That sown was thrown out. It hit the ground. But notice Satan was there to to cause problems with that seed. Right? So he doesn't fully understand it. Satan comes then and snatches away what was sown in his heart. Here we have what's called as the wayside Christian. I would submit to you, this is the lust of the eyes. There are emotions here. The full understanding is not readily unavailable. It's this mental game. And Satan comes in and plays that mental game with that person. It's the lust of the eyes. Verse 20. But he who received the seed on the stony places, this is he who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. Yet he has no root in himself, but endures only for a while. For when tribulation or persecution arises because of the word, immediately he stumbles. This is the stony Christian. And here we have a description of what I would submit as lust of the flesh. Remember, lust of the flesh is about that physical gratification. Tribulation hurts. Challenges are difficult. Right? When things get hard, verse 21 here, when persecution arises because of the word, right? It's not persecution arises because of society's pressures and me being light society. Right? If we're light society, there's no persecution there. The persecution is coming because of the connection back with God's way of life. Right? That's where the tribulation and persecution arises. It's because of the connection with God's way of life. But remember, lust of the flesh is connected with this physical gratification. Tribulation hurts. It's uncomfortable. It's not pleasant. I want to make myself safe again. The self-protection mode kicks in, and we do what we have to do in order to protect ourselves. It's the lust of the flesh. Verse 22, now he who receives seed among the thorns is he who hears the word, and the cares of the word and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and he becomes unfruitful. Here we have the thorny Christian that's falling to the temptation of pride of life. Right? There's riches, there's fame, there's power, there's control, there's authority, there's whatever it is custom made for you and me. There's this vain assurance in our own resources. And it gets choked out. Over in the book of James, we see this described in yet a different way. James chapter 3. James continues preaching about these three tactics of Satan. To further reinforce this, let's notice James chapter 3 and verse 13. James 3 and verse 13. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom that does not descend from above, right? This wisdom that's based on the bitter envy, the self-seeking, right? This selfishness, this me-first mentality, right? It's that kind of wisdom that does not descend from above, but rather is, notice, earthly, sensual, and demonic. The kind of wisdom, the kind of selfishness that exudes from within, that fall prey to Satan's tactics, these are not from God, James writes. Instead, they're earthly. This is the lust of the flesh. It's tangible things. It measures success in worldly terms. Its aims are worldly. It's unable to go beyond the limits of this world in order to gain matters on spirituality. The limits of the world are Satan's. Right? Satan is the God of this world. Why is there great suffering? Well, it's not God's fault. This is Satan's world. Right? There's suffering in the world because of lawlessness, because of these tactics that Satan is using on the world. But this sort of wisdom can't go beyond the limits of Satan's world in order to gain perspective on spiritual matters. Notice, secondly, first, it's earthly. Secondly, it's sensual. This is the lust of the eyes. Remember that mental gratification. Sensual things are mind-based. When you think of something that's sensual, it's mental. It's inside. Jude 19 is a very interesting reference. I'll let you read that later. Jude verse 19. It talks about people who are lawless, people who are against God's way of life, and describes them in Jude 19. Jude writes that these are sensual persons who cause divisions, not having the Spirit, right? Not having the Spirit of God in them. They instead devise these things inside their head in order to cause divisions. Divisions always start from the sensual perspective. There's the dreaming, there's the power, there's the control, there's the following, there's the acknowledgement that you're someone great. Jude 19 is an interesting reference here. Thirdly, that James describes, the lowest step here is demonic. This is the pride of life. This is simply, you can be God. Right? You can be like God. This produces the kind of situation that Satan delights in. And in many ways, this is Ezekiel chapter 28, in verse 17, speaking of Lucifer. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You have corrupted your wisdom. Right? Lucifer allowed his wisdom to be corrupted. And so this is perhaps the lowest step here, this demonic step, the pride of life. You know everything. You can be like God. You can successfully build this tower into the heavens, right? You can be this symbolic gatekeeper. You can go to and fro. You are God. Becoming desensitized, though, is a slow process. It's very methodical. It's a methodical process that Satan uses against us to slowly grind us down, to wear us down, to tire us. It's a gradual move toward apathy. Let's go back just a page, perhaps, or two, back to James chapter 1. There's a progression of events that lead to sin. And when we look at these tactics of Satan, we should consider them in light of this progression, this formula, if you will, that James gives to us. Because if we can identify the tactic early enough, then that sin hasn't been born. We can nip it in the bud. And this is the encouragement for us, to identify it early, to not let it take seat, not let it get to the point where we're taking that quarter degree turn to one side. James chapter 1 and verse 14. Each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Right? Here's where it begins. It begins with desires and enticement. It's what the serpent did to Eve. It's what Satan attempted to do with Jesus in Matthew chapter 4. It's what James warns about in James chapter 4. It's the temptations you and I are faced with on a daily basis. It begins here with desires and enticement. Maybe it's some pride of life facet. Maybe it's a physical gratification. Maybe it's a mental something. But it begins here with desires and enticement. It's not yet sin. Okay, it's not yet wrong. The old King James Version says lust and enticed. Drawn away by his own lusts and enticed. It means the same. In the Greek, it means a longing for, right? But specifically a longing for what's forbidden. It's not a longing to better keep the Sabbath. It's not a longing to better love your neighbor. Right? It's a longing toward what is forbidden. This is what the Greek here seems to imply. There's an allurement. Thayer's describes it like a bait. Right, whether you spring trap something in the woods and you hide it, you're baiting an animal, whether you're fishing, you put that lure on and you sort of hide the hook and you throw it out into the water. It's to catch by bait is Satan's tactic here. So verse 14, Each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then, verse 15, when desire has conceived, right? When desire has conceived, in the Greek, this means to seize or to clasp, right? We've taken the bait, or that fish that thinks it's a worm, but oh no, it's not a worm. Now my stomach hurts and I'm being pulled the wrong way, right? We've accepted that proposal. Verse 14, the proposal has been put out. Hey, Eve, wouldn't it be nice to be like God? Have you considered this? Right? Maybe you should eat this. Right? Hey, Satan, just throw yourself down. God will protect you. Right? Each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire has conceived, we've taken it, we've internalized it, we've taken action on it, then it gives birth to sin. Right? That's when the sin occurs, when we take it in, when we decide to go along with those thoughts. Hey, wouldn't it be nice? Yeah, wouldn't it be nice? And those things play through our head, or we allow those selfish motives to come in. When desire is conceived, then it brings forth sin. The design of all of this is to show that sin is not traced back to God. Right? Sin is never traced back to God. Right? Sin is our own doing. It's Satan's temptations. It's his influence. It's the pressures of society pushing on us, converging on us. Right? But the sin doesn't trace back to God. It traces back to Satan. Right? It traces back to the things that he is attempting to get us to accept in our life. There's enough potential on ourselves to sin that it doesn't need to be traced back to God. Our own actions bring forth that sin. And then the last part of verse 15, when it's full grown, it brings forth death. Sin is finished. There's no more innocence. That temptation, that desire, that allurement went unchecked. Action ensued. And now the sin lies in front of us. And if unrepented of, then the last part of verse 15, it brings forth death. Right? If it's unrepented of, when that sin becomes full grown, right? When it's full grown, when it has gone unchecked, when we've failed to acknowledge it, failed to repent of it, failed to bring it before God's throne and say, I have this thing and I'm very sorry, please forgive me, help me to change. Right, when we fail to do that, that sin becomes full grown and eternal death then is forthcoming. Here's a couple of verses for you. Matthew 26 and verse 41, as far as the overarching question, why do we sin? Right, why do we sin? Matthew 26, verse 41, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Right. Romans chapter 7 ties in here. You have the Apostle Paul saying that what I want to do is not what I do, and I don't want to do is what I find myself doing. Right? Matthew 26, verse 41, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Romans 13, verse 14 is another reference for you. Romans 13, verse 14, make no provisions for the flesh. Right? Make no provisions for the flesh. If we drain the swimming pool, if we drain the pond, right? There's no place for Satan to throw that lure in. Right? We've changed the environment. Right? Make no provisions for the flesh. When we're aware of Satan's tactics, then we can pray to God and say, okay, this is my weakness. This is where my flesh is weak. Spirit is willing, right? Matthew 26, verse 41, the spirit is willing, the flesh is weak. Help me to shore up this area of my life. Right? Because as the fish, I bite every worm that comes in front of me. Right? Help me with this. 2 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 1 is another reference that you can read later. 2 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 1. Paul tells us to cleanse our minds from all filthiness. We can look at the world around us and say, well, there's a lot of filthiness out there. Right? Filthiness in marriages, filthiness in sexual immorality, filthiness out of Hollywood movies and music and even driving down the road with the way people drive, the anger that people have, right? There's a lot of filthiness in our world. But what is filthiness? Filthiness is simply things that are not godly, things that are not aligned with the kingdom of God. Paul tells us there in 2 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 1 to cleanse our minds from those things. Don't drive like other people drive. If someone wants to cut you off, you don't need to floor it and go and cut them off. Don't follow the ways of the world. Cleanse our minds from those gentle and often subtle pools of the world around us. And that, for you and me, is the great challenge, right? Because those pools are gentle and they're subtle and they're small and often hidden. Let's go to Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12. Here's the great encouragement based scripture for us today. Yes, the world is evil. Yes, the world is sliding toward Gomorrah and Sodom, and it's moving in a direction that academically we can all say, we don't want to be a part of the world, right? The world is moving in a direction I don't want to go. Subconsciously, though, we can find ourselves taking these fractional steps toward society. Right, we can have this misconception that as society goes down, as long as I'm staying some distance above society, that I'm doing okay. Right, but that's dangerous. Right, if all we're trying to do is staying so many feet above society, if society is trending downward, then we're also trending downward. Right? We have to be very careful of these things. Here in Luke chapter 12, this is the great encouragement for us. This is the great motivation and focus for us as we move forward. Yes, the world is sliding. Yes, Satan's influence is tremendous, but you and I have God on our side. Jesus Christ is faithful to finish what he has started in each of us. If we're mindful, if we're cognizant of society's pulls, if we're aware of Satan's tactics, and we're praying and we're staying close to God, then these are very encouraging and beautiful words for us. Luke chapter 12 and verse 35, let your waist be girded and your lamps burning. Right? Let your waist be girded and your lamps burning. Right? There's action here. I'm always to be girded. Right? I'm always to be having God's way of life be my focus. Right? And lamps are burning. Right, I'm always working on applying godly wisdom in my life. I'm always asking God to give me his wisdom that's from above, his understanding. I'm always looking to apply that in my life. I'm always looking to have God's character be what I'm focused on building each and every day. Let your waist be girded and lamps burning. And you yourselves be like men who wait for their master, when he will return from the wedding, that when he comes and knocks, they may open to him immediately. Right, we don't know the day or the hour. Right? This is where we started the message. Right? Jesus Christ is saying, only God knows. Right? But we can be ready. We can be attentive. We can be those faithful servants who are watching their own lives, watching and being mindful of Satan's tactics and temptations. We can be individuals who are on guard for those minute degree movements toward that broad road that leads to destruction. Verse 37, blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, will find watching. Right. These are individuals that are focused on action. They're watching. They're attentive. They're not just aimlessly hanging out in the woods. Right, they see the pair of eyes stalking them, but who cares? Now, this is an individual who is attentive. This is a person that is alert, that is mindful of their spiritual condition, that is focused on making sure that they have oil in their lamps that causes that lamp then to burn. Right? This is an individual who's focused on God and God's way of life and asking God to to put more of his spirit in them. Right? This is the person who, when the master comes, will find watching. Assuredly, I say to you that he will gird himself and have them sit down to eat and will come and serve them. What an incredible picture for those individuals that are watching, that are mindful, that are diligent, that are alert, that are focused on ridding their lives of these previous micro movements toward the broad road. Here we have this visual of Jesus Christ coming himself and girding himself and serving those individuals. What an incredible visual. He will have them sit down to eat and come and serve them. Verse 38, and if he should come in the second watch or come in the third watch and find them so, blessed are those servants. We don't know when he's coming, right? But blessed are those individuals who remain vigilant. Is he coming tomorrow? We'll find out tomorrow, right? But between now and tomorrow, I'm going to be watchful of my spiritual condition. I'm going to be mindful of slowly becoming desensitized to these pressures of Satan's society. It's all about being alert, being aware, watching where we are spiritually. We can all agree that the world around us is evil. But would God agree with what we personally define as evil? Therein lies the big question. We all know that evil is out there, but would God agree with our definition of what that evil looks like? In conclusion, let's go back to Genesis chapter 3. Let's read one more verse here as we conclude this afternoon. Genesis chapter 3, and let's notice the first part here of verse 22. Genesis chapter 3 and verse 22, this is after the man and woman have eaten, they've sinned. There are curses that God gives to the serpent and to the man and to the woman in the middle part of the chapter. And here we sort of see one final piece of judgment that God ushers out here at the last part of chapter 3. But let's read the first part of verse 22. Then the Lord God said, behold, the man has become like one of us, to know good and evil. Right? Man has become like one of us to know good and evil. The UCG Bible commentary makes this statement, quote, Adam and Eve did indeed come to be like God in the sense of knowing good and evil. But just what does this mean? To answer, we might ask, in what way does God know good and evil? One very important way is that he determines it. That is, he decides what constitutes good and evil. And that is what Adam and Eve now did. They determined for themselves what was good and what was evil, end quote. You and I can look at our environment, and we can look at our participation in society around us, and we too can make certain determining conclusions. But as that first man and first woman looked within themselves to determine good and evil, let's be careful that we also don't do the same. We should allow God to determine what is good and what is evil, and then submit ourselves to that determination. In the coming weeks, let's be ready for mental combat. Think about what we view. Contemplate what you read. Let's ask ourselves, where is this coming from? How does this make me want to think? Is this the way God thinks? What does this thing want me to do? These are important questions to consider as we evaluate good from evil and these temptations that Satan brings forward to us. Brethren, let's be fully aware of how Satan tempts us to sin. Let's be on alert. Let's be on guard for how we could slowly be desensitized through the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes or the pride of life.